All right, hello and welcome. This is the Bottom Line Podcast by Ben Rogers, and you are listening to episode number 25. Today's date is August 15th, 2018, and I'm with a very special guest who has made an incredible impact not only in high school baseball in the state of Virginia, but in all of the athletes or student athletes he coached and he taught. A reminder that you are listening to a podcast that links lessons learned from sports, business, and life, and is designed to encourage you to get off the bench and go strive for excellence. The goal of this podcast is to highlight stories from small business owners, coaches, and others that are on the path to their own definition of success while the average competition sits on the bench. Today's guest is Coach Charlie Dragom, and to save me a whole lot of breath, I'll work some of his career highlights as a baseball coach into the conversation as we go. I will introduce Coach Dragom by saying that when I created the Bottom Line Podcast, it was done with guys like Charlie Dragom in mind. Big victories are important to aim for, but the small wins along the way is what the Bottom Line is all about. Process over the finish line and practice over the game is what Coach Dragom is all about. And with that, I'll go ahead and welcome in the now recently retired coach, Charlie Dragom. Coach, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate it and really give me the opportunity to come out here and made me kind of reflect on the last 25 years, which I haven't done often after retirement. So it's kind of good timing. So yeah. I do appreciate that.
Absolutely, man. It'll be fun. And I'll take a few notes as we go, too. So I'll help you reflect maybe another 25 years from now, telling you all the things you said.
And I might be sad after you reflect.
You had told me when we first talked about this, you're a big podcast guy. You said you're a big Tim Ferriss guy, right?
Yeah.
Any other big podcasts you like other than Tim Ferriss?
I get into a lot of motor learning stuff like Rob Gray and some of the, you know, Ron Wolfert and different folks that are kind of specific to the area that I like to kind of learn about. But anyone that's, you know, discussing greatness and the process and whatnot, I'm open ear to.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you – I'm a big I was never aspired to be in the military. But I love all of those guys, like the ex-Navy SEALs.
Yeah, Jocko.
That's what I was going to bring up. Yeah. I'm a huge Jocko podcast. Jocko, yeah. You haven't listened to Jocko podcast, I listen to his every
incredible
day. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, Coach, let's start just by giving us a background on yourself, kind of from you. You can fire away with anything you got.
Okay.
Let's go ahead.
Well, I'm a Jersey boy from outside of Philadelphia, kind of a suburb, which was kind of a neat upbringing. I happened to live in a neighborhood with a bunch of at the time, they were current Phillies. I think it had a lot to do with my interest at a young age in baseball. And I got to go on the field and in the clubhouse and stuff. So it was awesome.
And you're still a big Phillies and Eagles fan, right?
Absolutely. Go Birds. Yeah, probably a bigger Eagles fan than Phillies fan, but yeah. So that was neat to be around professional organizations at a young age at such a close level. And then, you know, my mom and dad were really supportive, both financially and as far as their time went. My dad coached Little League baseball all the way up. A lot of people don't know he was a hairdresser. A little bit interesting combination.
Right,
Little League coach / hairdresser. But yeah, I was a camp kid. We went down to Florida in the summer and winter times to see my Nana, who was living down in different spots around the Florida area, and I'd go to Boca Raton for a week. They'd go to vacation. I'd stay a week at camp in, you know, Clearwater, Florida, Miami-Dade. I went, I think, 4 or 5 years. So that was awesome. And then, you know, in the summer times, I was somewhere at Glassboro State, which is now Rowan. I remember there was like 3 summers in a row. I think I spent 3 weeks there. I didn't want to come home and just kind of, it was baseball camp, you know,
right,
sleepover. It was awesome. So that was very cool. I played baseball, football, and basketball growing up. And as I got closer to high school, I was influenced by a fella named Jim Horner. And it was like, it was the district over. So it'd be like being in the Hanover district and wanting to attend Lee Davis High School.
Sure.
So it was frowned upon. So my parents petitioned the school board, and they frowned upon it. You know, you're an athlete coming over. And the funny thing was, I was not a dynamic football player,
right,
of course. You know, I was literally playing offensive line in the 90s, the 110s, and the 130s, because all the kids big enough to play offensive line were too big. They outweighed.
Sure.
So I was slow. So they put me at, I was left guard. So I just
bowling
wanted,
guard, you need some quickness.
Yeah, right. So I wanted to be part, I think, of something that was great. And I don't even know why, because when I showed up, they had a freshman team, a sophomore team, a JV team, and and a varsity team, and they were the cream of the crop of any high school program, not just football. I'm talking like one of the top three programs probably in any sport across the state of New Jersey at the time. Multiple state championships, and just the pride in the program was unbelievable. And I was friendly with the head coach because his son had played within the same youth football program as I did. So I had this desire to go there. It wasn't like today where there's social media and you know a bunch of different people from different schools. I literally knew nobody, but I had this desire to go, and when I got there, I wasn't sure why, because I think I was like the fifth string. They moved the receiver because everybody big was now on the line.
Right.
And I was kind of shocked. Not shocked. I just was like, wow, this is reality. So, one, I think that at that point, I figured out, boy, I better start working on my speed if I ever want to be a skilled guy.
Sure.
As we move forward into my sophomore year, they put me up in the booth. And I was charting offensive plays for our incredibly knowledgeable and passionate coaching staff that was there, and I remember the feeling of like, man, I don't give a crud if the sophomore team or the JV team loses. We just need the varsity team to win. I really had nothing to do with the varsity team except I was keeping a chart for them. But the depth of that program and the attention to detail, and you know how the precision that the practices ran with, the lineman steps and the routes, the receivers and everything, was so intriguing to me. And I was like, wow, this is a first taste of a great program. And Jim Horner, the head coach, is in the Hall of Fame, and he's the bomb, and a guy that I owe a whole lot to.
So it sounds like, I mean, your high school football coaching staff sounds like a huge influence already in you wanting to get into coaching.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I didn't know it at the time, but I think it was, you know. And then as I moved through high school, my junior year, I got on the field a little bit. I worked really hard on my speed with one of my best friends who's actually passed away. And he was a great receiver, like me, kind of went in as nothing and came out as an all-state guy and ended up going to University of South Carolina. His name was Dave Pitchko, and played 4 years with Eddie Miller and Sterling Sharp. And it was, you know, awesome. Just one of those guys, just fearless and just a worker. So I got on the field as a junior, and then as a senior, had a great year. It didn't hurt that the head coach's son was actually the quarterback. So, you know, we got our opportunities, and I think I had like 11 touchdowns and 56 receptions.
That's awesome.
And ended up getting recruited for football. And I was a baseball guy, but I love football too. So I went on a few trips.
When you say you were a baseball guy, I mean, like, are you saying that just in hindsight or at the time you loved baseball?
No, I was still – baseball was my thing. Really? You know, I loved football because of the energy. You know, how can you not like high school football?
Sure.
You know, how can you not love high school football?
Right.
We had 5,000 people at a game. It was incredible. And we played on Saturdays. It wasn't Friday nights. At that time, Jersey was all Saturdays.
Mm-hmm.
And the energy of walking out of the locker room, I just remember, like, the pregame and, you know, guys banging weights against their head. I mean, it was intense. And then coming down, we had a beautiful – everything about the place was just – top notch, beautiful bowl stadium, down a hill, grass hill, and you walk down, and the fans are there, everybody slapping at your hand and stuff, and it had a kind of a college environment, and you cannot replace that with high school baseball. No. I promise you, it's just not the same. So yeah, that was awesome, but in my heart of hearts, I was still a baseball player, and
sure.
I wanted to play baseball. And at the time coming out, I was starting to get some opportunity, or at least some interest, in some small Division I schools. University of Maine, I went for a visit there. Kind of football, baseball. James Madison, the same thing. And this is in the mid-80s. And then Towson State were the three. And all of them.
So I guess kind of like the current CAA.
Correct.
Kind of, yeah.
It was about that level, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't think. I was like, at that point, I was like a 4.85 runner, wide receiver. I figured I'd be a dime a dozen. So baseball was still, I wanted to be my thing. So as you know, as it moved on through high school, I had a pretty decent senior year in because of course football's in the fall and baseball's in the spring. I had a good senior season in baseball and got to play in this thing called the Carpenter Cup, which is still going to this day. It was actually the first Carpenter Cup that was played. It was played at Veterans Stadium, and I happened to miss.
So cool.
It was great, and it was Delaware versus Pennsylvania versus New Jersey. So lots of good competition, and VCU just happened to be down there. I had to miss my graduation, Ben. I didn't walk because I'm one of those crazy kids.
Right,
you know,
right. Yeah.
So, but it was again, it kind of led me to my next coach that was one of the most influential.
Everybody knows you still actually graduate.
Uh-uh.
Just walking.
Correct. I did graduate. So that led me to my next phase of my life, which was VCU. They saw me there.
So that's what brought you to Richmond then. I actually never knew that.
It was after, believe it or not, you know, these kids commit so early now. This was after my graduation, and sometime towards the end of June, I'm guessing, where VCU saw me and offered me a partial scholarship. So I drove down to Richmond. You know, I just remember sleeping in the back of the car, and my dad was with me, and Coach Keys, and we get to the diamond. We pull straight up to the diamond. It was the first year VCU took the diamond over, and that's pretty impressive. Yeah. You know, you come down, and it's the south as far as a northern kid knows.
Right.
I'm like, wow, we're going south. Well, little did I know, it's still cold in Richmond, right? And so I get there, and the head coach is Tony Guzzo, who was actually a resident of Mechanicsville when he was the head coach at VCU.
Okay.
And as again, one of these guys that you just run into once in a lifetime, and I happened to bump into two of them back-to-back between my high school football coach and my college baseball coach, a preparation maniac, left no stone unturned, practices that were legendarily long. We commonly, because there was no restrictions back then, the NCAA had no fall restrictions or nothing, so we would play Richmond 20 times in the fall. We'd travel out to Virginia Tech. We'd go to East Carolina. He was a football player at East Carolina.
Really?
So to give you the mindset, he was a football coach coaching baseball. But he was not, I mean, only in mindset. He was a baseball coach, and he knew his stuff. So yeah, we'd miss cafeteria almost two or three times a week. But he was a guy that I realized that as a baseball coach, he brought the intensity where a lot of the time it was a laid back, kind of the game moved slow, but not there. You practiced at 110 miles an hour, and you attacked every game. Like how Hanover, I don't know, we've been kind of known for getting on and off the field. It was not optional, and that's where that came from and stuff like that. And we still do, it's kind of lore at Hanover is bear trips. I don't know if you ever heard of bear trips. Our kids, so in college, what we did was when the fall season was over, we basically ran sprints on Monday, distance on Wednesday, and these things called bear trips on Friday. And a bear trip is the team splits in half, and you got a minute and 15 to run a quarter mile. And then the next group goes in a minute and 15. And you basically run 15 quarter miles with a minute and 15 rest. And it is torturous. So we built up. We started in like November, and we built one. I mean, we went from like 5 to 6 to 7 over the weeks. Each week we added one. But the gist of it was when you come back from Christmas break, you run 15. Rain, snow, sleet, it didn't matter. And you did not get a uniform until you got 15. So after the 15th one, he would give you a second. And some of the big boys, the pitcher-only guys, they'd have to run 30 because they couldn't. So they would end up going from a minute and 15 to a minute and 30, but they would eventually get them. But he would make them run. So we brought that to Hanover, and it was just one of those things that, like, you could argue it's counterproductive for baseball. You know, you're not training the ATP system. We're not training the burst. It probably has nothing to do with it except being comfortable on getting comfortable being uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
And getting over humps.
That you know, you obviously coach Kevin, my business partner, and he actually has a sign on his desk that says "Need to get comfortable being uncomfortable."
Yeah.
And it still sticks with him today. And you mentioned earlier the getting on and off the field. I did a podcast with, he's actually my financial advisor. And he played baseball in Macon, big baseball guy.
Yeah.
He coaches kids, baseball teams, whatever else. And I was doing it right out there. And then he had mentioned something. We were doing something like the 10 most important lessons we've learned from sports related to business,
That's cool.
And he had mentioned one was just the pure hustle.
Yeah.
And so, like, immediately I texted him, I was like, dude, come out here, come tell your story. And so he talked about how you guys running on the field, and of course that went into me making fun of Kevin, because I used to watch him strike out and sprint back to the bench. It's like the sprint of shame,
oh,
you know?
Yeah, well, that's one of those things, you know, it's a mindset. Like, you know, we took a lot of pride in that, because whether we were up 10 runs or down 10 runs, we wanted the other team to know that we're there still to play. You know,
absolutely.
And it didn't matter. And it was a physical representation of, you know, you strike out, and now you're flushing it. Your sprint is actually the time to transition from offense to defense, or from defense to offense.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's those kind of things that I think build a program, because they're controlled. And, you know, it's amazing how many coaches and umpires over the years were like, that's like the, you know, I thought we played pretty good baseball and we did some pretty intricate things. And they'd be like, man, how do you get those guys to run on the field? I'm like, well, it's just non-negotiable. It's like what we do. You
yeah,
know? So
that's exactly.
And the kids take pride in it.
Well, it kind of reminds me a little bit. So when I think back, and you know, I don't know how many people are familiar with, I guess the 2005, 2004 through 2010 Hanover football baseball. But when I look back, I was a football guy.
Yep.
When I look back, I think four buckles, right?
Yep.
I think shoulder to shoulder.
Yep.
I think sprinting on and off the field. I think running through the line. And when I think of Hanover baseball, I think sprinting on and off the field.
Yeah.
And it's funny because you think of those things way before you think of the success the team's had.
Sure.
So it's all about the little things and the little steps along the way, right?
Yeah. And a lot of people don't see that. Even with the athletes, like, I like to talk to our guys about the NBA. Like, you know, those guys are a lot of flair and a lot of flash. But if you dig into what they do
to
get to that point, I mean, the discipline that those guys go through, and I mean, the way that they train with a purpose, and it's deliberate, and, you know, they have goals set, and they're, you know, they're reaching every day. You know, when they go out and they play on TV at night, you see the finished product, but right. you don't see what it takes to get to that point.
Exactly
because
right.
they're just not super freaks. They're predispositioned to be 6'7", but they have trained and worked more than anybody that's watching them on TV.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what sport you're playing either. And honestly, yeah. you relate it back to business. It doesn't matter what you're selling or what you're trying to accomplish. Your actual game or your actual big meeting or appointment or conference or whatever, the length of time that takes is so much smaller than the length of time and preparation yeah. that goes into
no
it,
doubt.
Right? And
no
there's
doubt.
So many little things go into yeah. it yeah. just to be recognized to be the winner.
Isn't that funny?
Right?
Isn't that funny?
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I definitely want to get back to kind of the non-negotiables, but let's go back kind of to your VCU, yeah. talking about your coach,
yeah.
Weston Allfield.
Well, so Coach Guzzo was very influential, and I can't, you know, thank him enough. So then at the end of my college career, I didn't get drafted, and I thought I might have had a chance. I was a little bitter, and it took
what position were you playing? I don't even know.
I was a middle infielder, okay. and I played third my first year. I got fortunate enough to get on the field my first year and play, and then our second year, I played third as well, and we were ranked, I think we finished 14th in the country.
Very cool.
Yeah, and it was the first winning season VCU ever had was my freshman year, so it was a really kind of an influential time
sure.
at VCU, so it was really cool. Then we were preseason ranked top 20 in the country my junior year and went like 20-0 to start the season and then hit the tanks. And it was really, really sad. And I don't even want to get in. I don't even know what happened, but that was disappointing. Long story short, I didn't get drafted after my senior year and I was a little bitter. I don't know if I appreciated how influential Coach Guzzo was at that time. You know, he pushed and pushed and pushed. And, you know, just and then my senior year, we weren't that great. So, you know, that when you're not winning and that grind's happening and continue, that can become, you know, it's conflicting at some mm-hmm. point. Not that it's right, but that's kind of, you know, I'm a young kid at that point still.
Right.
And so I didn't get drafted, but I still had another year of school and I'm working odd and end jobs. And then out of the blue, I thought I wanted to stay in baseball because it's kind of what I was about. And Jeff Zona, who you know, mm-hmm. the Zona boys, he calls me, he was a scout with the Red Sox at the time, and he said, there's a job opening at Lee Davis High School. And I had lived in Richmond for 5 years, and he's Mechanicsville.
You like, never heard of it.
Like
no,
the Confederates? I said, I'm from Jersey, man. I don't know.
What are you talking about? Where am I going?
Right, so I get in the car and go out there to interview for this job, and I meet literally the most influential person of my coaching career, who is Kenny Lewis. And I don't know if you know much about Kenny, but over the time,
I'm from Mechanicsville, of course. Yeah, I've heard about Kenny Lewis.
Okay, so you know Kenny. So he was hired as an interim coach that winter, and he said he would take the job if he could pick his assistant. And he wanted a baseball guy. So Jeff called him and said, you know, I got this guy, Charlie Dragham, and Guzzo called him. So, you know, the head coach of VCU and a scout for the Red Sox. And Kenny was like, got to know what he's doing, right? So he interviews me, and I walk into the school. And they're in construction at Lee Davis. It's the middle of the winter, and they're taking the campus style school. It was all outside, like Patrick Henry was, and they're converting it into an enclosed school. And his classroom, I'm telling you, it's 58 degrees. There's like a dust of like construction dust floating. And I knock on the door, and he's like, Coach Dragham, come on in, you know. And I sit down, I start listening. He's going over like U.S. history, Civil War stuff, and
obviously, they're the Confederates.
Exactly. And he's a history teacher, right? So within 5 minutes, I'm looking around, and these kids, I'm just trying to get my bearings. I'm like, what in the world is going on here? And these kids are on the edge of their seat, and they're riveted to his lecture. And I'm like, this guy's special.
Right.
And I mean, he is one of the best communicators I've ever met in my life. I tell everybody, he could be the head coach of a Tiddlywinks team, and he would be coach of the year every year, because he's a relationships guy. He could talk to administration. He could take a parent that was irate, and before the conversation's over, the parent's apologizing. He could relate with all the kids. He was a great motivator. He could get up in their butt if he needed to. But he really taught me, like, he hired me as the kind of, and he played baseball at Macon, but he has absolutely no ego. And I think one of the first things he said to me is, look, I'm not the big X and O baseball guy. I need somebody like that. And you're going to coach third. You're going to write the practice plans. And I'm like, man, this is great. And I thought I was going to teach him something. And it turned out that I just sat in awe and just kind of took in for 9 years. I was his assistant for 9 years. And I loved every minute of it. And I still feel like pure coaching, leadership. He could have been a lawyer, a politician. He could have been anything he wanted to be. And he just really enjoys working with kids and going that route.
You mentioned him as a coach and a teacher. You mentioned that he's a relationships guy. He's a great communicator. Maybe it's one of those two things, but if you could say, you say he's a great influence. So with that said, if you could sum up why he was a great coach and a great teacher and a great leader just with one or two words, what would it be?
He was brilliant, first of all. I mean, his intelligent level, and he's a storyteller. Like, you know, he can just relate, man. He's just so good at that kind
of
stuff.
It's so funny you say that because I have this thing on our team. We have like our three core beliefs, and I call it the five C's to sales success. Mm-hmm. Right? So you go from confidence, competence, competitiveness, care, and consistency. Like, and I think Kevin is the king of competency. Mm-hmm. Kevin's extremely smart and knowledgeable about the subject matter. Mm-hmm. And I always like to say that competent or stories sell, but competence closes. So it's really interesting. Interesting to hear you say he's a great storyteller, very intelligent, competent. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So you're lead Davis assistant coach for 9 years, and then I think you got your first head coaching opportunity.
Went over to Attlee, and I had discussed that with Kenny because, you know, going from Lee Davis to Attlee was, you know, that wasn't, I don't know. I didn't know if it would go over real big, and I didn't want to disappoint the players that were playing for us at the time. But anyway, I did it because really the reason why was Hanover was on the books, mm-hmm. and it was going to be built, and I wanted to start my own program. And I felt like if I got some head coaching experience, I'd have a better chance of getting a head job at Hanover. And, you know, I stayed at Attlee, cut my teeth there for 3 years, made a lot of mistakes, did some really good things. But, you know, it was a kind of a short period, be there 3 years and then jump ship again because – I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to start my own program. Mm-hmm. And so Bobby Stratton, who was the old Attlee coach, when I took that position, he took the AD job at Patrick Henry. Then he got the AD job at Hanover and hired me.
Yep.
And if you know Bobby, as you do.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually trying to line up one of these with him.
Yeah.
He'd be a great guest.
Yeah, great guest. He dots his I's and crosses his T's and very detail-oriented, cares about the kids and the coaches. And I felt like I always was protected with him.
He just got inducted to the Virginia High School League Hall of Fame.
Yep. Well-deserved. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for Bobby. And so he hired me. And you know, really what I wanted to talk about Hanover was, one, the players, and two, the coaches. Because, first of all, the coaches, I could go on for hours. I could do three podcasts with those guys. But to keep a high school baseball coach around, a high school baseball coaching staff around for literally 10 years, the core group of like six, is unheard of because they're working for free, really working for free. And, you know, it was just the commitment, and they all were lifetime learners. They were so passionate about Hanover. And I could go through and list names, but they just, every one of them was
I think it's awesome of you to give the credit back to them. I think just at least for our listeners, even if I don't know how you take it, because you're a pretty humble guy, but a lot of that starts from the top and with leadership. They stick around for free because they like their leader.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that I think they like me, of course, but I think, and I learned this from Kenny, honestly, was like, find good people to do the job, because a head coach is only as good as an assistant, but you have to let your assistants, you have to delegate and give them their sandbox and figure out what they're good at and then go with it, man. So I'd like to sit in a game and literally I would do near nothing. I was just kind of looking over the entire, and we'd get to this later, but like we got away from like micromanaging and we made a philosophical decision at some point that we were going to talk a whole lot less to have them own so they could be more seamless in a game. And it was at the time that we really started winning, so I like to pat myself on the back and think that had something to do with
sure.
it. I don't know, but yeah, the coaches, man, they did their thing, and I think that's one reason why they stay around. Nobody wants to coach if you're going to listen to the head coach talk all the time. It's just not very satisfying. But then the kids, that first group that came through, and Patrick Long, Kevin's mm-hmm. brother, was one of them, and that group was one of the top three special groups that's ever come through. They would have done anything that the coaches said to help get them to the point where they wanted to be and where we wanted them to be. And back then, we were kind of stupid, and it was like torture camp. You know, we were a lot tougher conditioning-wise. We weren't as smart as far as preparing baseball players, but what we lacked with that, we made up with toughness.
Sure.
And those guys were very good baseball players, really, really skilled. We could have made them better at that time, but they were as tough a group as I've ever coached, and the quality of the kid of that group, A.J. Caritas, Robbie Bailey, Billy Graham, Kevin Davis,
I remember watching them. I do.
The second year in existence, they won the region, and mm-hmm. it was an unbelievable region. The two kids that were on the two teams that ranked ahead of us all year were drafted in the first round.
What were their names? Godwin and Hermitage. Were those?
Yeah,
two
it was Godwin and Hermitage. It was Bristow and Taylor.
That's right. The two pitchers. I remember watching. I really do. I remember
being a kid because they hosted in Hanover.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And we beat somebody. Midlothian beat Godwin, and everybody, and they thought, well. Then so Hermitage was playing us, and they kind of overlooked us, thinking they were going to have a walk to the state now because Godwin was out, mm-hmm. and Kevin Light waxed just threw a great game, carved him up. And
Kevin Light's a client of the Rogers Long team, powered by Hometown Realty.
Is that right?
Bought a house from us a long time ago.
One of the best pitchers to ever come through Hanover High School.
Lefty.
Yeah, no doubt, man, no doubt.
That's awesome. Well, you know, you talk about them being one of your top three groups. It reminds me of, you know, when we went through our rough years over on the football side of things.
Sure.
And, you know, when I talked to our head coach, who's one of the, other than my dad, the largest influence in my life,
Coach
Josh Just.
Yeah.
And, you know, he talks about his favorite teams being the years when the results weren't great.
Right.
But the toughness was the best.
Sure.
Right? And it leads more success down the road. But you opened up Hanover, I guess it was 04, with your first season, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just some things I wrote down, I've mentioned in the very beginning some of your statistics. Region title in your second year in 2005, three-time state champion 2013, 14, and 2016, and two-time state runner-up in 09 and 17.
Correct.
That's a ton of success. I mean, it's unbelievable. Congratulations.
Well, thank
unbelievable.
You. I appreciate that.
I've always been curious, kind of just a personal question here. What kept you in high school coaching? I've got to believe at some point the phone started ringing or you had some opportunities or something.
Yeah.
What made you want to stay there?
There was opportunities, but first thing you got to understand is high school baseball is – you're pretty safe. You know what I mean? I'm not getting fired if I take a – and not that I was ever afraid of that, but, you know, you've got – a lot of stability. You know, you're like, I'm getting paid to teach high school and I'm coaching baseball. And as far as, you know, because people ask that, like, you want to work with college guys, right? I'm like, well, you know, the skill guys that I worked with on any given team, I could have six Division I kids on that team. Now, some of them might have been freshmen, but they ended up being Division I kids, and some of them might have been seniors. And then the unbelievable amount of Division III guys and stuff. So the level wasn't there. I just felt like it was the kind of thing. What I really liked about it was, well, one, it was like my slow pitch softball thing. Like, I never had the urge to go out and play slow pitch softball or, you know, get in the woods and the competition against the game, the wildlife or whatever, or even like the Nassau on the weekends playing with my buddies. That was my release of competition, you know, coaching high school baseball. And you're a football guy, but literally school would start and you guys would be grinding, playing games, and everything mattered immediately. We trained from September right through the winter all the way until February.
Oh, yeah.
So it was like this long process that
I remember kind of slapping high fives to the baseball guys,
right,
training all of them off the track.
Right,
it was awesome.
Right. So that whole to see how the coaching staff could get the team from point A when, you know, we're just not a unit yet, to hopefully be playing a meaningful game literally on graduation day, you know,
right,
or like right there around it. So that whole process of and it was my baby, man. You know, it was like the kind of thing that I just took a lot of pride in, the field and our uniforms and everything.
Yeah.
And so did all
you,
of our
you
coaches.
Take pride in the little things, right?
Right. So that's kind of what motivated me to stay selfishly, I guess.
What you mentioned earlier that baseball kind of satisfies your competitive edge.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously if we've mentioned I'm the football guy, but
right,
why baseball? Like why is that your thing?
Well, I think like my association with being on the field as a young kid,
mm-hmm,
at the vet, and
sure,
being in the clubhouse and whatnot. But then the other thing was I was not God gifted with these tools of like being 6'5" and
sure,
running a 6'6" 7" a 6'6" 60. So it's one of those sports, first of all, that you can, if you work on your body and you and this kind of takes me into like a little bit of the football mentality is you train the bigger, stronger, faster. You guys train ability, which is brilliant. Baseball has been brainwashed into training skill. Like, they take their hitting lesson and their pitching lesson and they think they're working out and training, where you need to have a bigger motor, you know. So you can be a guy like me, 6 foot tall and of average build, and develop, if you work on the ability side, enough to be a contributing factor,
sure,
where that might not be the case at a high level at like football, at Division I football school, where you have to have some, you know, you've got to be a super duper athlete.
Yeah.
So I think you can affect, you can have a pretty big effect. You know, the guys in the big, like Pedroia and stuff that are just undersized, right, that are Altuve, you know, they can do some pretty special things. That's one thing. The game's really humbling. So, you know, it keeps you in check. Whenever you think you're great, the next thing you know, you're terrible because you succeed. You've heard it 3 out of 10 times in the big leagues. You're a Hall of Famer. That's so you're right. Failing 70% of the time. You know, all those things.
I think that's the best lesson in baseball. I truly do.
It is. I mean, you know, you see a lot of really talented kids in baseball that simply cannot handle the failure and the negativeness of it. And that's a shame. And that's something that we took a lot of stock in at Hanover. We literally did. We practiced mental stuff. You know, Brian Kane, Ken Revista, you know, we spent time in the classroom 2-3 times a week working on a routine and a mental game, which I felt like was something that that helped us a lot. Yeah. It helped our kids. So.
When I think of you starting Hanover baseball, because if the listeners haven't picked up on it, Hanover was a brand new school. Coach Dragon was the first baseball coach in its history, and next spring, was the very first spring ever, 2004, the Hanover has a new face of the program.
Right.
But when you first started it, or a new coach taking over any program, it really kind of, it parallels with a business or a new to the business salesperson or a brand new business over trying to start their own thing. Mm-hmm. And I think in order to do that, you have to have what we referred to earlier as non-negotiables, right? Things that are just absolutely non-negotiable that you have to have done. So for me on my team here in the real estate business, we have really 3 big non-negotiables. There's a positive attitude and a positive energy, period, right? Presence is your greatest attribute, meaning that you are in the office and you are working face-to-face and you're a great communicator. And then finally, you believe in the relationships first, transaction second mindset.
Yeah,
and so those are 3 non-negotiables.
Right.
When I think of a non-negotiable for Coach Charlie Dragon, I obviously think hustle.
Right.
So speak to that a little bit and maybe talk about some other non-negotiables you implemented and really why you did and how it went over and how you did it.
Yeah. Well, like I said, when I first, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to start my own program, because it was so much easier to come in where there's no past history, you know, of previous coaches and what the expectations were. So to start my own program, it was like taking candy from a baby, really, with the kids we had. I mean, it really was. They were such good kids. And we just went in with the mindset that, one, the first pillar of that would have been the hustle, that we were going to out-hustle regardless of how you were individually doing, how the team was doing. If you weren't choosing to hustle at practice, and we don't believe in the gamer, it was like, you know, you had to get it done at practice too, you weren't going to be playing, you know. So that was the first thing. And then I could list, you know, hundreds of controllable actions that we had that were mentioned over and over and over again. You know, like the mindset when we come out of the locker room, when they hit the gate at the bottom of the field, there's a line and they start their jog, and that's to clear their brain from school to start baseball, because, you know, you got to coach the whole athlete. That's obvious. Kids got problems at home and kids have girlfriend stuff, but we really wanted them to come into the field every day with a clear sense of understanding that they're trying to get better today. And our mantra was from the first year, the kids came up with hard, smart, together, and then it was squat up, and all of those. If you think of playing hard, is that controllable?
Yes.
Absolutely. Playing smart, controllable, absolutely. And playing together, it has nothing to do with winning games or anything like that. So all those were non-negotiables. And you know how our kids wear their uniforms; they're not allowed to untuck their shirts. I see other high schools at like Marty's or somewhere, you know, with they're still their high school baseball uniform, half of it off, they got shorts on, and I think it just looks trashy.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had a rule that they do not, we're on the road or at home, until they get into the locker room and take it off to put it into the laundry. We didn't let them take them home ever. Their uniforms were tucked in, their hats were on with their hair above their, you know, their hat line. You know, national anthem, we always held it for 3 seconds after the last note, so we don't have kids like bending down to pick up their glove. You know, those little things go a long way. And like you said, umpires. They weren't allowed to have conversations with umpires. It's a waste of time. You know, they ump, we play. So that kind of stuff was important. The whole, you talked about preparation. You know, preparation is critical, you know. And we talk about confidence coming before success. And then, so how do you get, you know, how do you get success? How do you get confidence? And the only way that you can get confidence, in my opinion, is to out-prepare the other folks.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Okay. Well, that's what we're built on. And I'll tell you a story. So we're in 2013. We're down in Hartsville, South Carolina, and we're on a bus at a spring break trip, and it's pouring rain and really good tournament. And our bus driver that year was this guy named Coach Gore, driving for Wynn. And he's got this rock on his finger that's about this big, and it's a state championship ring. Well, he happens to be the running backs coach who drives a bus for L.C. Byrd. He drives a Wynn bus in his off time. And he just turned into one of our coaches. He literally drove, Ben, I'm not kidding you, for every spring break trip from there on out to I left, and every state tournament run that we had. And so the reason why was we were there, and he says, Coach, let me put in 300 for these guys. You know, on the charter bus, and the kids are all sitting there, and we're waiting, it's pouring, we can't even get off the bus. And so he puts in 300, and our guys kind of gravitated towards it. And one particular scene, if you remember, what is your profession? Mm-hmm. So Daxus is the leader of the Arcadians, and they come up to join forces with the Spartans and Leonidas, and Daxus is like beside himself. He's like, I can't believe you didn't bring, we wanted to fight with you, but you don't have any men. Yeah, right. We have more men than you. And so Leonidas turns to the first, what is your profession? And he says, well, I'm a potter. And what are you? And I'm a sculptor, and I'm a blacksmith. So then he turns to his troops, and what is your profession, Sparta? Right. Yeah, and so, and then, you see, old friend, I brought more soldiers than you. So we embedded that into our culture, that our guys were full-time baseball players, and they out-trained and outworked everybody. And we wanted them to know that, so that they, when they went into a game, they knew that they were better prepared. At least, I mean, they might not have been, but we wanted them to believe that they were better prepared. But I can't imagine, with the hours that we trained and as much time as we put into it, that we were out-prepared. And I felt like that always gave us a chance. You could still be more prepared and lose. It just was a process that gave you an opportunity to win.
Well, that's what, you know, I talked about earlier, the five C's, and then I have what's called the bottom line. And that's where the name of this podcast comes from. But the bottom line to me is preparation.
Yeah,
preparation can improve your confidence, your competence, the way you care about things, how competitive you are, right?
Yep.
How consistent you are, whatever it is, preparation and truly believing in practice over the game. You mentioned earlier that yes, hustle's important during the game, don't get me wrong, but if you're not hustling during practice, you're not going to get into the game.
Right.
So we're going to hustle from by the time we hit that line until we get to the dugout.
Yeah, and in high school, you know, baseball's meant to be played over, you know, in the big leagues, it's 162 games. College, they play 60. In high school, we literally play 20 games. Mm-hmm. So we practice three times as much as we play. So if we're not making good use of our time at practice, we are getting worse. It's just, there's just no two ways about it. And then the other thing to that was, to kind of relate back to my college coach, is like, it transferred really well for what I was getting into high school coaching, because it was literally like a football game. If you watched us play, there was a lot of intensity.
Sure.
It wasn't like you didn't have time to sit back and relax, because one, their seven inning games are shorter, and two, we only played 20 of them, and every one mattered. So we wanted to attack it like a Friday night football game every time out.
So I remember telling you when you were mentioning earlier that in 05 when the region championship against Hermitage and Gowan, I remember being a freshman, because I guess that was the spring of my freshman year. And I actually played JV baseball that year, so I was probably sitting in the stands.
You were in a program.
Yeah. At one point, until I became one of those specialized athletes, I guess. But I think it ended up working fine for me.
Yeah, I think so.
I remember sitting there watching those games, and just, it was mind blowing. I was like, "This is baseball."
Yeah,
you know, I've never seen baseball played like that, and it's amazing. Yeah. We talk about all these things between preparation and hustle, and you know, the hard, smart, together, whatever it is. We haven't even talked about how to swing a baseball bat.
Right.
Yeah, we got three state titles under our belt.
Right.
You know what I mean? And
right.
So I just think that's the mindset. I think that can go a long way beyond sports too. And so I was going to ask you, with those kind of non-negotiables in mind, what would be an example, by name if you want, you don't have to, of a player that you've coached who has kind of taken a few of those non-negotiables, and you've seen them find success with that, whether it's off the field or currently still on the field? Who's somebody that comes to mind?
Well, I know, I was thinking about this, and I, first of all, when you're coaching, and I don't know if Coach Just mentioned it or not, but like, you know, you press and you push, and the bar is so high. And sometimes, you know, I got done 26 years, and I wasn't even sure. I'm like, man, did the kids, even though kids have come back and stuff, and just like, did they like me? You know, was it too much? Was it too much? You know, it's only high school baseball, but it was pretty important to us as coaches, and I'm sure to the players too. when I retired, my assistants put together a surprise party, and like 50 kids showed up.
I remember Kevin was telling me about it.
And it was awesome, man, because it made me feel so good, because a lot of those guys shared stories of how they're using the lessons that they learned, not necessarily from me, but from the program, and how they're using them in their everyday life. And, man, it is awesome. But, you know, two guys, I'll tell you, the 2019 didn't win a state championship. They lost a championship in the state final game. And the first kid was a bullpen catcher who just literally, he would tell you he was never going to play college baseball. You know, he just wasn't. And he was had the heart the size of Texas. And we all wanted to be part of the program. And I told him, said, look, bud, you're not going to play hardly ever. But you're going to catch bullpens. You're not going to have at-bats and BP because you're going to be down there catching. And he understood his role and where he stood on that team. Not that he was any less important than the guy that was pitching or batting in the third spot. He was as important, if not more, than the majority of the guys on that team, just from his selflessness and how he approached his preparation. And his name was Jeremy Setlin. Mm-hmm. And what a great kid. And he's going on. He's an engineer. And he's told me multiple times, he's written me a letter, like, you know, how thankful he was that I gave him a chance. And, you know, it was just so fulfilling. And then the other guy off that team is kind of on the other end of the spectrum, and you'll know him. He came in from Ohio, and he was probably my favorite one or two Hawks I've ever coached, because he wasn't very skilled as a sophomore.
And I was actually going to bring him up because of a Facebook post he made, if you remember.
Yeah.
But keep going.
So as a senior, he turns out, after his junior year, he had a disappointing junior year, and he's like, Coach, what do I need to do? What do I have to do? And it wasn't like the old, what do I have to do? He literally was trying to figure out what the heck he needed to do. And I think I said something like, well, Austin, you don't run great. You got to hit the ball in the air and get the second base. That's where the game's played from. And okay. And so he was special in a sense that he worked, but he did so many little things around the field and in the weight room and around the school and in the classroom that he had carte blanche to say anything he wanted to any superstar player, because we had some really good players on that team, anytime he wanted, and they listened to him. So, and we always talk about peer leadership and group leadership being so much more powerful than coach leadership. And that was him. And he was just one of the most competitive kids in the regional semi game. This is pretty funny. We're at RF&P, the park, beautiful park, and we're playing Godwin. And we get there first, and we always like to take the third base dugout because selfishly I coach third and I wanted to be close,
right,
be able to talk to the team. Short walk, I'm getting old. So,
were you sprinting to and from?
No. I walked. Sometimes if I was upset, I ran a little bit. But so we're in the dugout, and John Morano, the coach at Godwin, comes down and he says, hey, coach, it's predetermined Godwin's in the third base dugout. I said, you're right, John. I said, okay, guys, pack it up. And one of the Godwin kids is like talking to his friend, but standing on Austin's corner of Austin's bag as Austin's sitting on the bench packing his stuff up. And I just happened to walk by, and Austin like looks up at him and gets his attention and says, you're standing on my bag. And with this look, and then stood up and kind of chest bumped him. And this kid was 6'4", Austin's probably 6 foot, and this kid quivered like a leaf in a windstorm. And I turned to Bobby White and I said, we're good.
Yeah, we're fine.
We're going to be fine. So, and we ended up waxing him. So it was like, he was that kind of kid, man.
Yeah.
He just was infectious with his competitiveness. Like, he used to get in, like, I think, fist fights with Trey Davis. We used to call Dr. Hoops,
right,
playing basketball, you know, pick-up basketball.
Yeah.
They would be, like, you know, up in each other's face. So.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, those two. And, you know, he went on, and you said he wrote that Facebook post that was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know, and I could name 20 guys like that, you know,
but
just to pick two, those two were pretty special.
That's awesome. What my next question had to do with, like, kind of what is one little thing that bridges the gap between, you know, your average and your excellent, but I think you kind of just answered it. You talk about Jeremy kind of understanding his role and being selfless, right? You think about Herb earning the right to lead and speak because he did the little things every day.
Right.
And I think it just all comes back to, sometimes you just got to get up and do it and get going, right?
You can't lead if you can't, no one's going to follow. So you have to be a leader because you've earned it. That's
right.
Why we never even go team captains, never, because I could appoint team captains, but if they're not the guys that the team thinks are the leaders, then it's worthless. So we just never did them, and that was our philosophy. I don't know if it was right or wrong, but it worked out pretty good.
Right.
But I would like to address one thing between
Please.
Good and great.
I would love to hear it.
Yeah, we always talk about the difference between good and great. Like, good is the enemy of great, right? Mm-hmm. Of course. But more from, like, a team perspective. And this is something that we did. And again, I don't know if it was coincidental, but at some point in, like, 2010 and 11, we've got this feeling that we were pretty good, but we couldn't get over the hump. And we really felt like we were over coaching. And the leadership was more like, you do this, you do this, you do this. And we were like moving pawns during the game. And there was a lot of breakdown between what should have happened. And I think almost to the point where the kids were getting nervous. They felt like they were always being evaluated. So we made a philosophical collective decision amongst the coaches that we needed to figure out a way to practice different and to back out a little bit and have less ownership to make them own it a little more. And it was like we were having rain was coming in at the end of a practice. It was really cold in like the end of February, the beginning of March. And what would usually happen, a tarp pole, they would get out there and then they'd start pulling it, and I or one of my other coaches would run out there and start telling everybody what to do. And I remember this. So they went out, they were all messed up, the tarp was all crooked and stuff, and I started to walk out. I like put my hand up to start pointing, and I just shut up. And I walked back to the coaches. I said, let's just let them take care of this. We got lights. We could be here all night. You know, literally, it's 160 by 160. It's a big tarp. And they end up starting it, and they're not getting anywhere. And then one guy steps up and leads, and then the next guy says something. Before you know it, the whole team's communicating. We're like, that's it, man. That's what we have to get on the field. So we literally took all controls. Like, instead of me putting on bunt defenses or first and thirds or a pick or whatever, we did nothing anymore. We prepared them in practice so that they could do it on the field in a game. And it became so much more efficient and seamless that we could run whatever we wanted anytime. And they took ownership in it. And it was, like we said, that peer motivation and peer discipline is so much more powerful than the coach. And I think that's the lesson you can take into the like into the business world. It's the leader of the organization doesn't have to be the one screaming and yelling all the time. I kind of equate it. I feel like I should be telling them what to do about a third of the time. There should be some really good interaction between myself and them on like a collaborative effect on what we need to do. And then that last third, I need to not say anything, and they need to take control of what they're doing, you know? And that, I think, tends to empower them a little bit more and to get them more engaged in what their actual role is as a player rather than just waiting for a coach or a boss to tell them what to do. And that's what you want. You want your staff or your players or your team to take initiative and own it.
I was trying to take notes, though, and make sure I understand, because that's awesome. As a leader, you're basically teaching, right? Yeah. About a third of the time.
Yep.
Collaborating, working with about a third of the time.
Getting ideas from them.
And then delegating the rest of it and letting them handle on their own. Yeah. And taking ownership of their actions and their responsibilities.
Because they get to the point where they're almost like looking for you to tell them what to do when it's crunch time. And you can't win championships like that. So, like, we made that change. And I don't know that, like, we just started having opportunities to win states every year, and I really do feel like that had something to do with it. We have obviously had great players, but I think that was a stepping stone.
That's huge. That will be in the description for the iTunes episode. That was awesome, man. That was great. We're kind of starting to get towards the end here. I wanted to ask. I know you mentioned Kenny Lewis, a huge influence for you. Going back, maybe at that point, just growing up, as a player. Growing up as a child in high school, what is the single greatest lesson you learned from sports?
Man.
And how it would turn, I mean, I know you're a coach, but just how it helped you in life.
Well, two of them. And I think it can be productive and non-productive at times, but like I really like winning. You know, like I just was blessed with being, like, from my little league teams, we won the state championship. I didn't tell you, in baseball, we won it my junior year. In high school, and we won football my senior year, and then all through the coach. And I swear I don't remember being on a losing team. And that sounds like it's result oriented, but there was a lot of process that went into that. I played on I played with a lot of coaches that understood that the process was so important. And I think most teams that take care of the process end up having an opportunity to win.
100%.
So I feel like expecting to win and knowing how to win
has
been critical. And then I can remember one specific thing that happened to me when I was a young kid. I was 11, because I thought I was one of the better players in our little league. And, you know, in little league, you have all-stars. And I think something similar like this happened to your brother, if I'm not mistaken, why he quit baseball and he never should have. I tried to get him to play every year for 4 years, but he never did. I didn't make the 11-year-old All-Star team. It was the 11 and 12. So it was like the stuff that you see on TV, you know, Williamsport, though. And my dad was a coach of our team. And, you know, I was just crushed. It, like, I remember literally him telling me I didn't make the team, and I cried. I was just, at 11 years old, I was, like, bawling my eyes out. And all my buddies were on the team. You know, it was a matter of pride and stuff. So I think at that point, and his response was, you know, you're going to have to work harder. You just have to do more. And so I did. You know, I felt like it made, and it, I think it made me a little bit more resilient. So that in that's one of the things I remember from childhood that was impactful. You know, that you got to have thicker skin, and if you want to succeed, you got to find a way to work and train a little bit harder.
Yeah, it's so, huge. Yeah. I was I have a business coach I'm on the phone with twice a month, and I was talking about, you know, what's the next step? You know, in our business in real estate, this time of year is actually surprisingly slow because people are on vacation. Last year, I was like, you know, what's the next step? How do I kind of break through right now? We're at a good spot, but overall, I feel like we're kind of plateaued. What do we do from here? He's like, well, it sounds kind of cliche, but you can work harder, right? Yeah. And so the way he kind of laid it out made a lot of sense to me, because that, of course, you can work hard, right? But he said, what you really need to work hard on is continuing to become fundamentally exceptional.
Yeah.
Like, that's a huge trait of a leader, right? Is becoming fundamentally exceptional. And so what he equated it to is really cool. He's like, all right, it's JV versus varsity, right? Can you, in football, can you be on the 1 yard line and can you go on two and not be the clown that jumps off sides?
That's great.
He's like, that's what being fundamentally exceptional is all about. So what we do is we go back to the drawing board and say, okay, we're going to get better. We're going to train. We're going to coach. We're going to teach.
Yeah.
We're going to collaborate. We're going to work together. Yeah. And eventually all that planning, practicing, and preparation is going to lead to bigger and better things, without a doubt.
That's awesome.
All right. I think I'm kind of done with the questions. I mean, that was pretty awesome. You feel good about most things you said?
Yeah, man, I do. I really enjoyed the interaction.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, this is fun. Yeah, I mean, what I'd like to do is, as we continue going with this episode number 25, I'd like to kind of check back in with guests as we go and kind of see where people are in life. You know, I got folks that are currently coaching, retire from coaching, maybe some that are my age and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's cool kind of track people throughout their lives and seeing how they take these small lessons of process and practice and preparation and continue to show it in their life.
Saying I'm old.
Older than me, yeah.
Yes, I am.
I typically like to end these episodes with a challenge to the listeners. Maybe it's a story, a quote that kind of help them get off the benches of mediocrity, as I say, and kind of go get after it. In whatever they're trying to accomplish, right? Today, I was going to ask you to do that, and I had asked you this to prepare something for this. So whether you have a quote, a story, something you heard on a podcast, whatever can help somebody to motivate them to get off the bench, that would be great.
Well, as far as getting off the bench, I think the first thing is, and like you did it with this podcast, is taking that first step. I mean, I've been there, man. Like, I'm starting a business right now in PH 101 because I feel like we need to do, Hunter Hoy and myself, we need to do something. We've been doing it on the side and kind of like, but to, we're not business people. You know, we're coaches. We're high school coaches. I'm a PE teacher, for God's sake. So, you know, to take that step and jump right in, and now I need to get a whole lot better at setting up a business, understanding payroll, all that stuff, which really scares me. But, you know, we talked to him. He said, let's just do it. Let's just educate ourselves, be a life learner, and just keep getting better at it. So getting that one foot in the door and starting is huge. And then the other thing is, like, continuing to learn. I just really feel like the educational end of it, reading. You got, like, the podcast. There's so many brilliant people out there that can really influence you. And when you think, you know, I know this. The more that I think I know and the more I research, I figure out how stupid I am. And that sounds crazy, but, you know.
I get it.
If you're the smartest guy in the room, you're an idiot. Because, you know, that's the kind of thing where I just seek I just want to find new ways to do things and keep it fresh and keep it moving. But, yeah, I think there's so much out there to learn.
And that's huge. You talk about getting off the bench. So a lot of times people think, man, I've plateaued. I'm average. What do I do? Where do I go? And then they think about all these things they want to do, and it's so much at once. Just take one step.
Take one step.
That's it. Just one, right? Yeah. It leads to the next one. Right? Yeah. You stand up and go.
I mean, seriously, like when you exercise. Like if I go and I'm in a good routine of exercise, I'm eating right, it's no problem for me to get to the gym, everything's good, let me go on vacation for a week. And then I come back that next Monday, and I feel like, what happened? I can't make myself go to the gym. You know, I mean, it's that same type of thing. I think you get complacent, and it breeds complacency. You just gotta step out and get going again.
Complacency breeds complacency, and activity breeds activity. It's exactly what it
was. Absolutely. So a quote that I had was, and this was one we shared with our MPH guys last week, and so we do a lot of mindset stuff in the beginning of these classes, and then we definitely hit a quote, and it's Henry Ford, basically, whether you think you can or you can't, you're probably right.
Right.
And that's such a strong play on words with mindset. You know, if you think you can, there's a really good chance that you will. And if you're having doubt, there's a good chance that you can't. And there's ways to practice having a good mindset, self-talk, you know, being in a routine, having a plan, all that stuff is there. You can practice your mental game just like you can make your bicep stronger.
Absolutely.
You know, and you have to be proactive with it. And then the other one was, and I really thought about this because of your brother, who was, I admire him. I know my kids are sick and tired of hearing about Sam Rogers because, you know, he's a Hanover product. I actually had him come out and talk to one of our teams in the playoff run. And it's just like, man, how could you find a guy? Because, like, what he did, it's like the easiest thing in the world and the toughest thing in the world at the same time. Anybody can go out and work hard and do and train differently. But it's the hardest thing in the world because it's really physically and mentally demanding. And to see a guy live it every single day was like, you guys need to watch that guy. And if you really want to be great, that's – and so the quote I had was, if you train like everybody else trains, you're going to get what everybody else gets.
That's right.
And he's a perfect example of if he did what everybody else did, he might have been a Division I football player. He might not have been. He might have been a Division III football player. I know he would not be playing in the NFL right now. And he just figured out he knew he needed to train differently than anybody else. And he didn't let anybody else look at him and say, what's the Rodgers kid doing? You know,
that's right.
He had his goal and he did it. And, you know, that's a message we send to our throwers all the time. You know, don't get sucked into the norm because that's the norm. You're crazy until you prove that you're not. You know,
right.
And a lot of times we were ridiculed with what we do, and then all of a sudden everybody's doing it now. Right. You know, like around this area. So it's just an interesting concept.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a big believer in this. I believe that we're all born average. I believe that we're born with a blank slate.
Nature
right?
versus nurture, man.
Exactly, and it's your responsibility to get up and go. Some people might be fine with being average, but you're not going to get the results you want. It's pretty kind of cut clear and dry.
Exactly.
Coach, thanks for being here. This is awesome.
I really appreciate it, and I wish you good luck with it. And,
thank you.
It's really cool that you started it.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
I will be a listener now. I've only listened to about 3 or 4.
So. Very good. Well, I appreciate you being part of the Bottom Line Army. For sure, and definitely helped me on my mission to impact and influence others who might need a hand in getting off the benches of mediocrity. I do believe that laziness has become a commonplace in a lot of areas, and it's always refreshing to hear from a guy like you who not only intends to make an impact, but truly acts on it every day. So
thank you.
Thank you to those who have listened to this episode number 25, which I have now decided to name Hard, Smart, Together, an interview with Coach Charlie Dragham. That's the tagline, right? Hard, Smart,
yep,
Together.
That's it.
Beautiful. Please remember to share this podcast with your average friends you think would find some benefit and on your social media platforms for all of your acquaintances to see. Once again, he is the coach, Charlie Dragham. I am your host, Ben Rogers. This is The Bottom Line, and I'll talk to you next time.